So before starting into the realm of quantum gravity, maybe take one step back and look at classical gravity as we know it. So this is given here. We have a theory which describes gravitational phenomena, Einstein's general relativity, and the equations of motion are written here. So the theory itself contains two coupling constants, so there's Newton's constant and cosmological constant. And in principle, our experimental friends can go out and measure these two things. And then you find a value for Newton's constant and cosmological constants, and they tell you they work perfectly fine on scales on the submillimeter range up to cosmological scales. So experimentally, we have no reason to go beyond this for the time being. But there are some conceptual puzzles which are associated with this action. So first of all, we can ask about the forces in nature. So we have the electromagnetic strong and weak force, and they are well described by quantum field theory. On the other hand, we have gravity, which is classical. So there is a conceptual mismatch between these two points of view. Then we can also ask, what about the structure of space-time if we go to smaller and smaller scales? So beyond the submillimeter region, it's something that will change based on our viewpoint of general relativity. And then maybe the most famous puzzle we have is the smallness of this cosmological constant. So why is it the value we have here? And why do we need this tremendous amount of fine-tuning? And ideally, there should be some guidance to this question. And that should be provided by a quantum theory of gravity. So how can we approach this problem? So in an old-fashioned way, we would try to apply perturbation theory. So that was done in the early days in the 70s. And then it soon turned out, okay, the Newton's constant, which we have in the action, this has a negative mass dimension, and this leads to all kinds of problems when we quantize this thing perturbatively. So, naively, we need an infinite amount of counter terms, and the assessment is that general relativity as it stands is perturbatively non-randomizable. So, bearing some resummations which get around this problem, were not available at this time, we were thinking about, okay, we need something else. So what are the conclusions we can draw from this? The first thing is we know that general relativity works very well, so it could be an effective field theory. So from this point of view, we can compute corrections in E squared over Planck mass, and this we can do independently of how the theory behaves in UV. However, this will break down when our energy scales approach the Planck mass, so that might not be very satisfactory. The second thing we could assess is, okay, we want an UV completion of gravity, so maybe we need some new physics to do this. And then you can be inventive, say, okay, we have supersymmetry, maybe we have extra dimensions, or maybe we have to modify the framework of quantum field theory to make sense of this, of gravity at all scales. There's also a more modest point of view, more conservative. So maybe gravity itself can make sense as a quantum field theory, but this problem we have above here is actually a failure of perturbation theory. So assessment, the UV completion requires going beyond perturbation theory. And this is the point of view we are going to take in this talk. So what could be the proper framework to do this? And then it's useful to actually look into Wilson's formulation of randomization. So here the central building block we have to describe our theory is its randomization flow. Essentially, that tells you that we have coupling constants, which describe our action, and these now depend on some randomization group scale, which I will denote as k in the following. And the quantum effects which we have in the theory are then captured by a randomization group running of this coupling constants. So that's the basic idea. And then we can contrast Wilson's formulation with the things we usually do in perturbative quantization. So in perturbative quantization, our central building block is we specify fundamental action. And on Wilson's generalization side, it's not so much the fundamental action which plays a key role, it's an RG trajectory which describes our theory. And then on the perturbative side, we like to work with randomizable theories. And on the Wilson formulation, this has its counterpart, saying that the RG trajectory we want to consider emanates from a fixed point in the UV. So this guarantees that our theory doesn't develop unphysical divergences. And then we also want to have predictivity of our theory. And on the other side, this is reflected of in the fact that the fixed point itself has a UV critical surface, and this UV critical surface has to be finite dimensional. So this is reflected in the fact that you have only finite number of coupling constants which you can measure, and then the condition that the trajectory is in the surface gives you some information about the other coupling constants. So this provides an infinite set of relations. So this table, as it is, may look a little bit simple, but there's some deep consequences hidden inside it. Namely, it provides a genuine generalization on what we can do within perturbative quantization. Namely, it first encompasses all theories which are perturbatively renormalizable. And these theories, the underlying fixed point, is a so-called Gaussian fixed point. So this is a free theory, and a typical example for this is, for example, QCD and asymptotic freedom. However, there's a second class of fixed points, the so-called non-Gaussian ones, and these are the genuine generalization of the framework we have above here. So this is the class of so-called non-perturbatively randomizable theories, and this is the generalization which brings us here, namely asymptotically safe theories. In the context of gravity, then there was the famous conjecture which brings us here to this conference, namely that gravity in four dimensions actually has such a non-Gaussian fixed point which controls its UV behavior so that the theory makes sense within the framework of non-perturbative randomization. Okay, so this brings me to the outline of the talk. So first, I will spend some time introducing a framework, namely the functional randomization group. So this can be used to investigate this conjecture of non-perturbative randomizability. Then I will review what we have found out about the theory space of gravity. So the focus will be on the results we obtained mostly in the last year. So it will be what did we do in the Einstein-Hilbert truncation, what did we learn about higher derivative gravity in this framework, and I will also resolve the puzzle Martin raised yesterday. So what about biometric truncations? An outlook, I will also say something about the role of perturbative counterterms in the context of asymptotic safety, and give some conclusion. So let's start with the framework of functional randomization group equations. So what we do to investigate the RG flow for gravity is we need a tool which can be used to study this flow beyond perturbation theory. And for a long time, there was nothing on the market to do this, and essentially the advent came with the recasting of the effective average action for gravity. So this was done by Martin Beuter in 98. So in a nutshell, the basic idea is we start from the gravitational path integral, and the idea is not to do the path integral in one piece, but do it on a step-by-step basis. So essentially that implements the ideas of Wilson and randomization,
So we have an effective description of our physics at a certain effective scale, k squared. And we have an equation which tells us how this effective description changes if we raise or lower the scale k. So the idea is to obtain this effective description, we split our fluctuations in high momentum modes, low momentum modes, we integrate out all the fast fluctuations to get this effective description. And I should stress that the application of these RGE equations is not limited to quantum gravity. So as we heard, we can also use it in scalar field theory, in quantum field theory, in condensed matter systems, where we also have other tools available to check that this is actually a sensible tool which works. So Martin already did a good job in introducing the basics, so I can be fast here. So our starting point is a gravitational action, which we only require to be diffeomorphism invariant. So we don't specify what our fundamental theory will be. And in order to put this into a path interval, we first perform a background gauge fixing. So we take our metric fluctuations, we split it into a background path and some quantum fluctuations, and then we have a gauge fixing term, which is actually quadratic in the fluctuation and otherwise built from the background. So this tensor y mu nu in the simplest case of a two derivative action that's just a metric, and here I also included a generalization, this covariant Laplacian square, which is suitable if we want to do higher derivative gravity theories. And then there are two gauge choices which we have, favorable ones. The beta, this coefficient being 1/2, this is harmonic gauge of higher derivative theories. It's also good to choose beta equals 1/4 because with these choices, the equations actually simplify a lot. Based on this gauge choice, we also have a ghost term, which exponentiates the determinant. So this comes to the action. Then we have a key ingredient, namely we introduce an infrared cutoff. So this was also explained yesterday. So this is quadratic in the fluctuations and otherwise provides k-dependent mass terms for the modes which we have here in the infrared. So the idea is, if we substitute this into the path integral, we integrate out this part while this remains untouched. And this is implemented by this infrared cutting. Yes?
On fields in this integral, or are you on a compact four manifold?
In the end, practically, evaluate to always have a compact background.
So you're on an S4 or something?
Yes. In the simplest case, it's an S4. There will be more to say about this later on in the talk. Okay, to derive
the flow equation, we then also introduce a source term and put this into the path interval, and this gives us the generating
functional for the connected Green's functions. And contrary to what we do in textbooks physics, this also depends on the randomization group scale k now. Then we can define a k-dependent effective action as the Legendre transform of this, and then the effective average action, we subtract here the infrared cutoff evaluated on the classical fields. So what is nice about this definition is we can now take the k-derivation and derive our formal functional randomization group equation, which tells us how this quantity changes if we integrate our fluctuations in the path integral. So formally, this is an exact equation. We haven't done any approximations yet. And it is independent of what we specify as a fundamental theory. So in this case, this fundamental theory can enter into initial condition for this equation. Then there are two limits to this equation. So I'm kind of rough here. So more details will be given in the talk by Elisa later on. So the limit where we have k goes to infinity, the equation gives roughly the bare or classical action, modulo some corrections, which we will see later on. And if we send the limit k to 0, provided it exists, then the effective average action coincides with the ordinary effective action. And solution, the theory itself are then specified by solutions to these equations. So these are a randomization trajectory, which maps the RG scale to a set of functionals, gamma k. So that's for the basic setup. Let me quickly summarize. So where our theory lives, that's theory space, it's spanned by all the action functionals, which we can build out of our fields, and which are compatible with the symmetries of our theory. The flow equation spans a vector field on this theory space, that's beta. And the integral curves of this vector field, these are our RG trajectories depicted here. And in the UV, they ideally arise from a fixed point, so that's the red point, and we can track the flow down to the infrared to get the effective action. So now we have this nice equation and also a problem. Namely, while this equation is exact, we cannot solve it exactly. So we have to get to an approximation scheme, and this scheme better be something else than perturbation theory. So you can also use it to do the usual perturbation theory, but here we want to go beyond it. And then there is a scheme which works well in other applications as well. Namely, we restrict the form of gamma k to certain sets of interactions, OI, depicted here, so which we consider to be relevant for the problem at hand. So we have some k-dependent coupling constants which multiply our interaction terms. We can substitute such an ansatz into our flow equation, and then we can project the flow onto the subspace which are spent by our ansatz. And by comparing the coefficients on the left-hand side and the right-hand side, we can read off beta functions for the couplings which are contained in our ansatz. But this seems to be a crude approximation, and we have to do some testing if this is actually something sensible, if the truncation we impose is reliable. And there are two things which are on the market for this. So within a given truncation, we can first check whether the quantities which we are computed depend crucially on the cutoff scheme which we have posed. So the cutoff scheme itself is unphysical, so physical quantities should better be independent of what we put in as a regulator. And the second and also crucial test of our results is to extend our truncation space and see that the physical features we are liking actually survive under this extension and have an analogous counterpart. So then it's time to think about what is the structure of this object gamma k. So a priori it can be very complicated, so it's useful to split it into various parts. So this roughly follows the first truncation that appeared in Martin's talk. So we can have some part of gamma k which is solidly built out of the physical metric. So this is the green thing which I delay the gravitational. So a typical example of what can come in here is the Einstein-Hilbert truncation that we have seen before, which contains two running coupling constants, and lambda, and possibly more. But all the terms are built from the physical metric only. And there are a lot of people who have worked hard on understanding the gravitational effect and the running of gamma k in this sector. Then there are some other things which come up in the classification. So there's the gamma hat, which contains terms which vanish if we set g equals g bar. And this is the typical form we get, for example, for the gauge fixing term or the mass term for the graviton. So there's a lot less known for this sector. And then there's also some quantum gravity effects that can come up in the ghost sector. So typical things would be the ghost wave function randomization, which we don't know for the time being. Or there's also the k-dependent curvature ghost coupling, which was recently investigated by the Jena. So this was Holger Kies and Astrid Eichhorn and Michael Scherer. And then a priori there can be many more things which we do not really know about. So for looking onto the result, what we know about the running of gamma k, let's start with the green part and talk about single metric truncations. So this is the sector which is best understood. So first is the question, how can we organize gamma k? So what are the interaction monomials we can put in here? And here I ordered them into a derivative expansion. So a priori, in an effective field theory, all these parameters would appear in the structure of gamma k. And then you can successively do approximations of full gamma k. So the simplest one is Einstein-Hilbert truncation, which only retains two monomials. And then you can successfully increase the structure in terms which you include. So there was the R squared computation by Reuter and Rauscher. Then about a year ago, this was pushed to include scalar curvature terms up to R to the eighth. And lately, there was also first computation which included these tensor-like structures. So this is the realm which we have explored so far. So the simple thing, the Einstein-Hilbert, so the setup was given here, and by projecting the flow onto the space spanned by this ansatz, we can get the beta functions for the dimensionless running couplings G and lambda. And here I have given an example for these beta functions. So this is for specific gauge fixing and a very specific choice of this infrared cutoff RK. And the reason to show these formulas is only that to show that we can do explicit computations. The structure, we get first order differential equations, which tell us about the running of G and lambda. And by looking at the anomalous dimension of Newton's constant, we see that we actually get arbitrary high powers of Newton's constant by expanding this denominator. So in a sense, the beta functions which we compute by this projection scheme actually contain non-perturbative information or information which arises from an arbitrary power of loops. From the Wilson perspective, the first question we should ask about these beta functions, what about fixed points? Do they exist? And the answer is yes. There's one, namely the Gaussian fixed point. So this is at G and lambda being zero, and this corresponds to the free theory. And it turns out to be a saddle point in G lambda space. So there's one and one repulsive dimension. But there's also a non-Gaussian fixed point, so this is as positive G, positive lambda, and corresponds to an interactive theory. And this one turns out to be UV attractive in both G and lambda. And this is actually the fixed point which underlies the asymptotic safety conjecture. So once we could show that this fixed point exists for the full theory, then this would correspond to having a full UV completion of gravity and showing that the asymptotic safety conjecture is actually true. But having the beta functions, we can do more. We can actually integrate the flow equation and get a phase portrait. So here we have G on the vertical axis, lambda on the horizontal axis, and the flow itself is governed here by the interplay of the non-Gaussian fixed point, here positive lambda, and the Gaussian fixed point in the origin. And all trajectories which we have in this realm are attracted to this non-Gaussian fixed point in the UB. I should also mention that classical general relativity, so this sits here on the trajectory, and what we also see is that once we start with a non-zero value of Newton's constant from here, the theory is actually not attracted to the Gaussian fixed point in the origin, but flows to the non-Gaussian fixed point. So this, in a sense, shows the failure of perturbative randomization in this RG framework. So the theory is not asymptotically free, but is asymptotically safe, and the UV limit is provided by the non-Gaussian fixed point in this approximation. Then we should ask, how reliable is this computation? So the first question we can ask is, okay, we can implement different cutoff implementations, different shape functions, and different gauge fixing conditions. And there have been work by many groups, so this is just an example, which computed the universal features of this fixed point in different approximations. So in this table, you should focus on the third and fourth column. So here is the universal product G lambda and the critical exponents of this fixed point. And you see that even though you do rather you go to very different gauge fixing and cutoff implementations, there is some universal features which appear. So the qualitative features of the fixed point roughly stay the same no matter what you do on this side. And in particular, it exists for all computations done in this Einstein-Hilbert framework. So this is the takeaway message. In the Einstein-Hilbert truncation,
but how should I adjust this? I look at 0.05 and 0.3.
Yes.
This is the same number, approximately? Or
approximately, that's the same number, yes.
Right. So more than one, both of them, I can agree with that, but wouldn't that always be the case? It's difficult for me to judge. So do we have some kind of quantity?
It measure? Gives you some feeling about how reliable. Or something like it gives you an estimate for the error bars.
Yeah, so
in which ballpark. And you could, what you can do is you can play.
But if I use a factor measure, then I have to multiply 0.05 by 6 to get 0.3. So there's a factor of 6 difference between these numbers. I don't understand what measure I should use to say that these are the same numbers.
Well, I think what you would want to do to be fair is to average those numbers, and then from the average, it's not affected.
No, I think you want to do, okay, Daniel.
You're referring to the four last lines, is that correct?
I'm referring to the third line and the L calculation and the worst of the CPR calculations.
Yes, but I mean, these numbers can be understood in more detail than.
Yeah, no, I'm just asking.
This is simply because you see there are different cutoffs used, okay?
Yeah.
Which means that different proportions of you see these cutoffs differ in the way you cut off your modes.
Yeah, no, I understand.
So the resummation procedure, which is underlying these numbers, is slightly different. It is reflected in the number G star lambda star.
Yeah, but that was exactly the test that Frank already did. We had two things we should test for the dependence of the cutoff functions and the dependence of the truncation. And that's both included here,
I guess.
As you say correctly, that reflects seemingly the cutoff dependence in these two numbers.
No. In a way, there's more physics in some of these because the cutoff, what equals 1, 2, 3, if you like, look into this, it means that different set of physics is already further integrated into the equation. So in a sense, there's a slight difference in the physics approximation behind it. All this can be understood. I mean, there's So that's the reason why you have a difference in these numbers.
No, but I think also at least it's part of the reason for the variations is simply that your regularized gamma k is simply on-shell gauge dependent. So as a show, if you were to use a gauge gamma k yet to be found, which is gauge independent on shell, at least the lambda stars for a given cutoff would always be the same.
So perhaps we'll have to last for 20 years, I
think. Yes, sure.
Okay, yeah. So maybe we can postpone the discussion session.
No, I was just trying to understand whether you would consider this good or bad, but you consider it good.
I consider it very good.
Okay.
Especially with this 1-3 classification. You do something very crucial in the implementation of how you cut off your nose. Okay, so now we should ask several questions which are raised by this Einstein-Hilbert results. So once we convince ourselves that the fixed point is stable inside the truncation, so what about adding different operators to our truncation subspace? Then we have this question which was already raised by Weinberg. So what about the dimension of the UV critical surface? How many parameters do we have to measure to determine our quantum gravity theory? And then there's a question which always comes up at this stage. So what about the perturbative counterterms, which include perturbative divergences? Can we say something about these? And these are the three questions I want to focus on in the following. So the first thing is, we can now move and include higher derivative scalar operators in our truncation. So this will give us some idea about dimension of the UV critical surface. And the idea is, instead of doing the Einstein-Hilbert ansatz, we can now put an arbitrary function of the scalar curvature into the gravitational sector. And by projecting, substituting this ansatz into our flow equation and projecting the flow onto this function fk, you actually obtain a partial differential equation for this fk, which tells you how this function changes with the randomization of scale. So once you have this functional partial differential equation, you can then go and expand it in polynomials in the curvature term. And once you have done this, you can read up the beta functions, and finding the analog of the non-Gaussian fixed point reduces to an algebraic problem, namely finding the zeros of these beta functions. And what you do in this procedure, what you find, is indeed that if you raise the number of powers of the curvature you put into, retain into the ansatz, then you find an analog of the fixed point in all extended truncations. So here I've shown only the results up to n equals to 6, and Sato and company also pushed it to n equals to 8 and 9. So the first line is Einstein-Hilbert. The second line includes an R-squared term. Then we have an R-cubed, R4, and so on. So in this extension, we find that the non-Gaussian fixed point is actually stable under an extension of the truncation space. Then we can also linearize the flow around the fixed point itself and look at the critical exponents. And here we find that there are also only three relevant directions, so these are indicated in red. And once we add higher derivative operators, there are only irrelevant directions being added to the fixed point. So from this table, we should note that there are only three relevant parameters which appear in, yes.
I'm just curious, what is the justification for keeping only some higher derivative operators and not all of them at a given order?
Ideally, you would move order by order in your derivative expansion. So this is what you learn from scalar field theory, which works good. But here it's a technical problem that it's much more complicated to do tensor structures than scalar operators. So for the scalar terms, you can work on a sphere, while the C squared term will vanish on a sphere. So in this background, you have no information on a C squared coupling, for example. So for that, you need to invent something more complex to get information on these coupling systems.
For example, having terms that go like R bonds R or something.
Yes, this is notoriously difficult. Okay, so from this table, we would conclude that there are only three relevant parameters, and it's the first indication that actually our unique critical surface is finite dimensional. So then the question already came up, what about these tensor structures like the C squared term? Can we do that them as well? And this was only at the beginning of the year where we started to consider extensions of the truncation in this direction by considering an ansatz which, besides the R squared, also includes the C squared term. So the idea behind this is that C squared encodes many characteristic features which are important for higher derivative gravity, like, for example, the 1 over p to the fourth propagator arises from having such a C squared term. Then there was already the question asked, what is difficult about doing these operators in our flow equation? And the reason is, for the C squared, you cannot work with spherical backgrounds as you have in the F of R case. So these are insufficient to disentangle the running of U2 and U3. And the solution to this problem was to relax the spherical background and go to a generic Einstein background. So on these backgrounds, you can distinguish these two types of operators. And then there was a second surprise coming up. So if you compute the gamma 2, this will contain differential operators.
So how can you distinguish them if they are equivalent up to topological terms? So are you going to...
The topological term?
While tensor squared is square of Ricci tensor minus 1/3 R squared.
Yes. And as you might see here in the list, I have not included the Ricci tensor squared. So what we do is we identify topological term with coupling, which is in front of Ricci squared. And this one we cannot see in this approximation, but we can see these two.
So you are tracing the topological term, that's what it is.
Yes. Then it was a surprise that all the differential operators you encounter in varying this action actually organize themselves into this Lichner-Hobitz form. So you can TT decompose the metric fluctuations into a spin 2, spin 1, and spin 0 part. And these are all the differential operators that arise in these various sectors. Then we can evaluate the traces which appear here with standard heat kernel techniques where the differential operators have this curvature terms as a potential. The result is shown here in a schematic form, just to see that we actually did this computation. So schematically, we have the flow equation here. We get the tensor fluctuations, we get the scalar fluctuations, and this is the only thing that actually knows about what we put into the gravitational sector of the average action. And then there's some universal contribution. So this arises from the gauge sector, the ghost fields, and some auxiliary fields, which you introduce to exponentiate the determinants you get from the TT decomposition. So here we have an explicit form of the flow equation, which we can then evaluate. Then we can ask, okay, what about our favorite fixed point? And here we show that indeed, even in this R squared or C squared truncation, we find an analogon of the fixed point that appeared in the R squared computation. So in the first line, we have the R squared or C squared result. Below that, it's the R squared computation by Lauscher and Reuter. And below that, we have the computation done by Roberto Percacci and company at the one loop level. Yes?
So the model in red is the model Lee was mentioning this morning, no? The R squared plus C squared.
Yes.
So then I will come back to his question. How do you know this fixed point is not the fixed point he was mentioning? You know, we already know this model has a fixed point, which is asymptotically free from U3, but you could blame the fact that it's not completely zero on the truncation. So how do you know it's not that fixed point?
You can compare the critical exponents of the one loop fixed point and this fixed point we computed here in the R squared plus C squared. And then you will see that the running of the coupling constants are actually different. For the asymptotic freedom, you have the logarithmic running of the mu, while here you get a critical exponent which is actually non-zero. So you would conclude that it's actually two different fixed points.
So you still see the fixed point asymptotically free one?
Yes, we reproduce all the one loop results, but we produce, similar to the beta functions you have in the Einstein-Hilbert, we also get infinite power if we would expand in the coupling constant sigma. Then I should also show the critical exponents of this new R squared plus C squared fixed point. And here we actually find that, again, there are three UV attractive plus one UV repulsive direction. But I should stress that this is complementary to the R F of R computation which we had before. So here we are probing a different UV repulsive direction as, for example, the R cubed term probes. The fact that we actually have one repulsive direction in the setup also has some crucial consequence for let's say, phenomenological purposes. It's a bit open-minded. So in order for the theory to be on the UV critical surface, we have to impose a relation between the coupling constants. So three coupling constants we can choose freely, and then the fourth is determined by the fact that we are actually on this UV critical surface. Then we could trace this relation to the infrared and see what it means for infrared physics. So saying if you think in terms of an effective action, this would be a prediction of asymptotic safety. You measure three coupling constants, and then you can say, okay, the fourth one has to be determined in terms of these three by the condition that we are sitting on the UV critical surface. So in principle, this is something we could measure in the infrared. Then I should move on and also resolve the riddle we raised yesterday, namely, what happens if we go to this bimetric setup and include a non-trivial gamma hat term in our truncation? So the philosophy we had before with the single metric truncation is we had only had terms which were from the physical metric G, but now we could also include terms which depend on G and G bar. And this will modify the structure of the flow equation. So we have first flow equation for the green part, for the single metric. And by looking into this orthogonal direction, we also get a flow equation for these new terms which are built from the background metric and the metric itself. And as Martin already mentioned, this is a good approximation if this combination T minus T, which appears here, is actually small. But a priori, we don't know if this is the case. In fact, there's a there are some arguments that these terms actually do play a role, namely the effective average action, as we put it, has already changed in the setup, which are exactly of the structure. So the gauge fixing term, the ghost term, and in particular the infrared cutoff, we put it in this construction, actually has an H dependent, which does not combine with the G bar into the physical metric G. So we would definitely like to understand the role of these terms. In particular, you could argue that the infrared cutoff plays an important role in the UV, namely structurally this term goes like k squared. So it could be that it is quadratically divergent in the UV. So it could source strong effects which will go away from the surface G equals G bar. The second question, which automatically arises with these truncations, is if we have two monomials, like the Einstein term, built from the physical metric and the background metric, our G equals G bar projection scheme does not disentangle these contributions. So the question is, if we do this approximation, do we miss some important physics in the setup? And then the first thing we did to probe this actually is work with this biometric double Einstein-Hilbert truncation. So the first green line is the Einstein-Hilbert, which we have in the single metric setup. And the second line are actually biometric terms, which are built from the physical metric and the background metric. So this is very similar to the bi-gravity theories that are recently discussed in the context of three-dimension and ADS-CFT. The problem of dealing with these truncations, so this question was already asked from people in Jena, is that our projection scheme setting G equals G bar no longer works. In this projection, we cannot distinguish between the physical metric and the background metric on the right-hand side. So the next simple thing is you can relate these metrics conformally and have a second expansion parameter epsilon. And then you can organize the terms in terms of curvature and small parameter epsilon. And this is good enough to distinguish the running of the coupling constants on the left and the right-hand side, but just looking at the expansion in R bar and epsilon. And then I should show the result. This is very similar to what we had already in the conformally reduced model. So here, Martin showed this. We have four types of fixed points. There's the Gaussian-Gaussian, Gaussian-non-Gaussian, and also a non-Gaussian version of the analog of the non-Gaussian fixed point, which we had in the single metric truncations. You can also compare the values for G and lambda, so this is pointed here, and what we get by including this additional distinction between the physical metric and the background metric is that the universal product G lambda actually changes by roughly a factor of 2. Yes?
Do you have other universal quantities when you increase the travel space in this case? Only this product, or there are other combinations that are universal?
I haven't checked yet. Oops, this one. Yes. And also, the value for the critical exponents, the ones we can compare to the Einstein-Hilbert case, they actually turn out to be at least in the same ballpark. So, as a...
Do you mean an eye on the top line?
Oh, yes. There I'm missing an eye. So they are both spirals. So also from the spine metric point of view, we get some support that the non-Gaussian fixed point, which we observed in single metric truncations, remains to be stable. It's still there. And surprisingly, even though we have some drastic new effects in the flow equation, the properties remain very similar to the ones which we observe in the single metric setup. So do I still have 5 minutes to talk about perturbative counter terms? So for the moment, I will leave the realm of pure gravity and go to a different theory, namely gravity coupled to a scalar field. So in this case, we enhance our theory space. So we have the metric and we have a scalar field in addition. Then we have an ansatz for our effective average action, which is of this form. So it's the r squared plus c squared truncation in the gravitational part, and the scalar field has a free kinetic term. So why is this interesting to do this extension? So you can read this ansatz from two different viewpoints. So the first viewpoint is, what would you do perturbative? Then you can say, okay, my fundamental theory is given by the red terms, so it's Einstein-Hilbert plus free scalar term, and then the green terms are the perturbative counter terms which arise in the one loop, which encode the one loop divergences of the theory in perturbative quantization. Then you can give a different reading to the red terms, namely the ones from the viewpoint of asymptotic safety. And there's an old result by Takachi and Perini, which showed that the truncation consisting of the red terms actually has a non-Gaussian fixed point with very similar properties as pure gravity. And the question you can now answer in this question is, so once we include these perturbative counter terms in our setup, has this some crucial influence on the asymptotic safety of the theory? So in a sense, yes.
By that sort of putting all the terms in the first line into the action, in which case the title of the slide would read, renormalizing the renormalizable.
Yes, in a sense, as I set this up, it's a toy model example for the Borov-Zagnotti counter term you have in pure gravity. So we cannot do the C cubed term, so this is the next best. So we can try to learn something from this.
That's all the rest.
The flow equation itself has almost the same structure as we had in the R squared plus C squared case. There's one additional contribution coming up here, which holds the whole contribution of the meta field. And this is actually a very simple structure. So we have one additional trace, which gives all the contributions coming from the second line. The computation of the beta functions then proceeds completely analogous as in the pure gravity case, except for taking this additional term into account.
Sorry, but so the coupling constants in terms of the R squared and the C squared term, are they fixed now? Or can they change?
They can change. They are K dependent.
Depending on what they came on, it can change.
Yeah, but they appear as counter terms, but anything you are doing what Max just said.
Yes.
But it's with the scalar fields, so additional divergences, and he's studying this.
Yeah.
So the scalar field is there for technical reason. In this case, the counter terms cannot be made vanishing on shell.
No, no. But as Max said, I mean, this theory is renormalizable.
The R squared plus C squared plus scalar field.
Yeah, isn't it?
It's prototypically non-randomizable at one loop.
But it has a P to the force property. if you do the expansion like Max would like to do?
In sigma. But here I would like to do the perturbative expansion in G, in the damage of the coupling constant.
It doesn't matter how you do it. You invert the, you find the propagator, which is the inversion of the linear piece, and it's the normalizer of the propagator, it goes like 1 over k. Is the result of Kelly-Stella?
I think the point is that those two, R squared and C mu squared, are, to this theory, what the Gorov-Sanyoffi term is to pure gravity.
So you shouldn't.
Therefore, by incorporating that one test, one does something similar to having Gorov-Sanyoffi term in pure gravity.
Sure.
So in the viewpoint, you want to quantize Einstein-Hilbert plus a scalar field.
And then you find you can't because there.
And then you find you can't because you produce the R squared and the C squared as a counter term.
Right.
And even on shell, you cannot absorb these counter terms.
Right.
And then you would conclude it's non-randomizable at one loop.
Unless you now take that as your fundamental theory.
As,
and
yes.
Yes.
But then it's randomizable.
Sure.
But this is not the point of view I want to take
okay,
here.
Okay.
Rather, I want to compare the results which we found for the non-Gaussian fixed point in case of pure gravity with the ones we obtained in the case where we have R squared plus E squared plus scalar field. So the first line shows how the fixed point moves in the Einstein-Hilbert case once we switch on the scalar field or not. So there we see both cases we have a non-Gaussian fixed point and it only changes very mildly. Then in the second line we also include the R squared plus C squared counter terms, and here we also see that A, the fixed point survives, and also its properties are very similar. So they are governed by the gravitational contributions to the flow equation. So having the additional scalar field is not devastating to the asymptotic safety of the theory. For completeness, we also looked at the critical exponents at this point, and also here this confirms the picture that the scalar field also only has a mild influence. So they are still in the same ballpark. We have three UV attractive relevant directions and one repulsive one. So also here, the additional scalar field doesn't play a crucial role. So this brings me to my conclusion. What have we seen in the talk? So on one hand, we have considered pure gravity, and all truncations which I've shown here have shown that there exists a non-Gaussian fixed point in our framework. So in particular, the higher derivative C squared truncations, which we computed, complement the F of R results previously. And also the bimetric truncations seem to confirm the picture which we have from the Einstein-Hilbert case. As a second result, we found good evidence for a three-dimensional UV critical surface in the gravitational sector. And this three-dimensional UV critical surface implies a relation between the gravitational coupling constants at four derivative level. Then we have analyzed the gravity scalar theory, including perturbative counterterms. And here we have seen that these perturbative counterterms are not crucial or devastating for the asymptotic safety scenario. Then there's the hope that the same will also hold once we are technically able to include the gravitational counterterm, the Gorov-Sanyoffi. So I think that's very encouraging in favor of asymptotic safety, but on the other hand, there are also many more things which we need to do and better understand.
Further questions? So what would happen if you consider a much simpler system, which is Young-Mills theory in six dimensions? So Young-Mills in six dimensions analogous to Einstein theory. it's by just by on dimensional ground. So you can add F cubed term, F d squared F term, and study same question. So you should, will you see asymptotic, will you see fixed point there, or?
As I understand the talk yesterday, no. I think it was in Holgaard's talk where he showed the plots that you have a critical dimension for a non-Gaussian fixed point, which is roughly F5. But maybe you want to comment on this question.
No, I mean, indication now that it's a first order phase transition, in which case there is not going to be infinite.
Six is too much.
The general question, if you see a positive cosmological constant, of course that's consistent with being on a sphere in the Euclidean formulation. Do you see any signs that the theory is at higher temperature, which is set by the Hubble scale? Maybe this is a general question to all speakers on this particular topic, not just for this particular
topic. Say it again.
This theory predicts a positive cosmological constant at this point, consistently with the fact that you start basically on a compact sphere, you're not imposing any boundary conditions at infinity, so you're doing a compact path integral. And so in that sense, the ground state in some sense should be a decidroid space, and there should be some sense of finite temperature associated with the compact size of the points at the path integral. Is there any sense in which one sees that this theory wants to be a finite temperature from the formula?
And I'm not sure whether I fully understand your question. It's because you see, as you know, provided a fixed point, everything is scaling if you don't any longer really have a natural scale which you would want to identify with the temperature. Because everything at the fixed
that's
point.
That's why it's a confusing question. I'm not curious.
Yeah.
Since you're starting with the path integral on a compact surface, I think that's considered.
I think the answer is another one. We use that these compact spheres only to project the flow. But we cannot say anything about the ground state. One can make any statement about what the ground state is. We use that only to do a projection. That's useful. That's it.
Technical device.
Yes. Technical device. But we don't know what it's there. But that's a general statement we can do about flow equation. But they don't tell you anything about the ground state, unfortunately.
Could you go back one slide?
Sure.
Last question.
Yeah. Do I understand we no longer have this imaginary part? These are now the real, these are no longer spiraling in that spiral.
In the R squared plus C squared,
plus scale.
Also in the pure gravity case,
they are no longer
spiraling. I didn't stress this,
but they are no longer
spiraling. They are no longer spiraling.
So let's break for coffee. You have a break of 20 minutes.